Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, I'll be playing the music of a pianist who grew up in the heart of the Harlem Renaissance and whose compositions have been celebrated and recorded frequently in the past 25 years. A gentleman who passed his own life mostly in obscurity, creating a unique musical universe. And I'll be talking with the author of a recent biography about him. It's Herbie Nichols' Third World, coming up next on Nightlights.
Thank you.
pianist Herbie Nichols performing his composition Cro-Magnon Nights with Al McKibben on bass and Art Blakey on drums from the Blue Note album The Prophetic Herbie Nichols Volume 1, a piece that Nichols said was meant to evoke a Saturday night function in the Stone Age and tribute to the creative imagination behind much of the music that Nichols wrote. I'm featuring the music of pianist and composer Herbie Nichols on this edition of Nightlights. When Nichols died in 1963 at the age of 44, he was unknown to all but a few young jazz artists and a handful of critics and fans who'd heard the LPs he recorded for Blue Note in the mid-1950s. Those who did know him nearly always spoke of a gentle, quiet, intellectually and creatively vital person. And from the mid-1970s on, his recordings have begun to circulate again, and his compositions have been recorded frequently by jazz artists, winning the respect, love, and acclaim that went missing in the pianist's own lifetime. As Nichols' friend and longtime advocate Roswell Rudd has noted, his music evokes everything from Africa and the West Indies of his parents' origin to the people and places of his mid-20th century New York City life, and to the strange and wondrous places of his own imagination as well. It radiates a kind of goodness, perhaps why Rudd has written that those who record Nichols' music improve the world by doing so. What world did Nichols himself come from? In his recent book, Herbie Nichols, A Jazzist Life, jazz writer Mark Miller makes a compelling case for the pianist as a product of the Harlem Renaissance.
He was born in New York in 1919, which is roughly when the Harlem Renaissance began. So his boyhood coincided with the golden age of the Harlem Renaissance, the 1920s. And I think there was an intellectual climate at that time that would have encouraged, or, you know, as I put it in the book, not discouraged his own youthful intellectual pursuits, as evidence in his admission that as a boy he used to live in the public libraries. It's something that he wrote in his autobiographical sketch. And the Harlem Renaissance concerns were also his concerns, both as a boy and as an adult, music, literature, art, as held to, you know, the highest of aesthetic paradigm, which is to say a European paradigm, while speaking of and to the African-American experience. I mean, I think it's worth noting that in addition to being a composer and pianist, he was also a poet, and a lot of his poetry survives, and he was a painter. And as far as I know, that doesn't survive, unfortunately. It would have been fascinating to see, you know, the visual manifestation of Herbie Nichols. But, you know, he did a lot of different things that expressed his creativity, his intellectual curiosity.
Here's one of Herbie Nichols' first recordings as a leader. His take on the Gershwin brothers is wonderful. Mark Miller writes that the pianist improvisation on this side anticipates the tendency of Nichols' later recorded solos to circle in and back on themselves reiteratively, rather than advancing steadily from one new idea to the next. Their forward motion would be rhythmic rather than it would be, in the manner of bebop, melodic. Herbie Nichols on Nightlights. Thank you. Nichols in 1952, doing the Gershwin Brothers' Is Wonderful with Danny Parker on guitar, Chocolate Williams on bass, and Shadow Wilson on drums from the Savoy CD, The Modern Jazz Piano Album. Herbie Nichols is celebrated today for his ahead-of-his-time compositions and musical sensibility, but in the 1940s and early 1950s, he was living and playing in the midst of the revolutionary bebop scene, and while he forged friendships with two of the movement's influential figures, pianist Thelonious Monk and Mary Lou Williams, he did not generally find himself welcome in bop circles. As Mark Miller says in his biography of Nichols, he was an outsider among outsiders.
As far as I could tell, he just didn't fit at all. There were some miscellaneous gigs in the 1950s with Lucky Thompson and Sonny Stitt. But in the 40s, even though he was on the scene at Minton's and Monroe's Playhouse, he was a very marginal and marginalized player. He was there, he listened. I think he was on the bandstand a bit, but the way he tells the story, he wasn't accepted. He seems to have been even too far out for the beboppers of the early and mid-40s. So that, once again, you get the sense of somebody who, musically, in this case, didn't belong in the company of his contemporaries. And, of course, socially, he was the straightest of arrows. He was he smoked cigarettes. I think that was his major vice, his major addiction. So he was really out of line with his contemporaries there. As well, he just wasn't one of the guys, one of the cats.
Nichols would eventually find acceptance from another source. In 1955, after years of lobbying, he landed some recording dates with Blue Note Records. Its co-founder, Alfred Lion, had a penchant for recording visionary pianists, and in the space of 11 months, he would record the bulk of what constitutes Nichols' musical legacy today. 5 albums worth of the pianist compositions. Appropriately enough, the title of the very first piece that Nichols recorded for Blue Note invokes the separate musical and personal universe that he inhabited.
The genesis of the term third world really has nothing to do, of course, with the sort of geocultural term that we use now. It was a situation where at some point in the mid-40s, he was doing a club gig with Sahib Shahab, and at some point when Herbie was playing, Sahib Shahab turned to him and said, "Man, you sound like you're in the third world," which is to say, I guess, you sound really far out. And Herbie took that as a compliment and used the concept of the third world in some of his writing and in some of his conversations as sort of an abstract of where he felt he lived as a musician in the third world. The track itself is, I guess it's a typical Herbie Nichols piece in the sense that it's very chromatic. There's a lot of harmonic complexity to it. I've seen it suggested that this was like a forerunner in its complexity to Giant Steps. And you get a sense with it right off the bat of the role that the drums play in Herbie's music, especially as recorded with the trios. That, you know, if you go through the recordings that Herbie made for Blue Note especially, you'll find Art Blakey and Max Roach getting solos, shots, spots, breaks everywhere, and rarely find a bass solo from Al McKibben or Teddy Kotick. So drums are really important, and The Third World was in fact the first track that Herbie recorded for Blue Note, so he was kind of laying it all out right at the beginning. This is who I am, this is where I'm coming from, this is what my music sounds like. Thank you.
Pianist Herbie Nichol is performing his composition, The Third World, recorded for Blue Note in 1955 with Al McKibben on bass and Art Blakey on drums, from the prophetic Herbie Nichols, Volume 1. Mark Miller on what lets you know you're hearing the music of Herbie Nichols.
I think the obvious one are his use of introductory figures that become outroductory figures, if you will, you know, things that are introductions and conclusions. He has this sort of wonderful sense of form. Wherever he starts, he ends. And even in the one long solo that he recorded with the Dixieland Band, it does the same thing. It's a little figure at the beginning, and he throws it in at the end. So there's a sort of structural sense that he has in his music that's very much his own. Melodically, it's very chromatic. It's kind of, I don't know whether knotty would be the word, K-N-O-T-T-Y, but it's very close and tightly bound. And it's supported by a sense of harmony that I think is fashioned to serve the purpose of each individual piece rather than to conform to any of the standard structures of jazz. So each piece is different harmonically. And that's all remarkably well integrated, all the different elements, harmony, melody, rhythm, really strong sense of rhythm. And for that, it's very difficult music to play. I think the other thing at a slightly different level is just the narrative quality of his compositions. They're very visual. His inspirations are events and places and people, I suppose. So that he's not just laying out a line. He's trying to evoke something that's very personal to him. Well, if you take a tune like The Gig, which is one of his better-known pieces, well, that's an evocation of what happens when a bunch of musicians get together for a jam session. And one of the things that you have in that piece is an extra bar along the way, a ninth bar in one of the sections, as if to represent the kind of confusion that a bunch of guys can get into when they're just first playing together. Like, whoops, we missed the change. We'll throw it under the bar. We'll catch it on the way around. And there's this kind of what strikes me as a grinding melodic figure, which it's like they're trying to get into gear and they're not quite getting, the gears to mesh. So that's the kind of thing that he's working on. There's a lovely sense of humor to this stuff. Thank you.
Herbie Nichols performing his tune The Gig with Al McKibben on bass and Max Roach on drums from the 1956 Blue Note album The Herbie Nichols Trio. Nichols biographer Mark Miller on the influences behind the pianist music.
I think the key quote from Herbie was his admission as an adult that when he looked back to his youth, that he'd always wanted to be a Prokofiev, which is to say he always wanted to be a classical pianist and composer. But the thing was, when he realized that as the second son of a working-class family in Harlem, the sort of education that he would need, the conservatory training, was just not going to be coming his way. When he realized that, he decided to become an Ellington. And there's certainly a lot of Ellington in his music, in his compositions, in his piano playing. But I think he always continued to aspire to that sort of classical ideal of the Prokofiev. And you get both of those things. You get the jazz tradition and you get the classical tradition coming through in his music and his compositions. And he was, you know, by his studious nature, which is part of being the intellectual that he saw himself as being, and it's part of his curiosity, being studious. I mean, he just absorbed the entire tradition of jazz piano up to the point in which he entered it. So he knew about Morton. He knew about Hines, he knew about Teddy Wilson. He was obviously a witness to the rise of bebop. So he had the whole history of jazz piano under his hands, and that too comes through in his music.
Nichols' creative energy took other forms in addition to music, including writing about music for New York area journals.
Herbie saw himself as an intellectual. Of course, writing was something that intellectuals did. There's a bit of a forced quality to some of his writing. I'm not sure that it's great writing necessarily. But how many other musicians in the 40s were writing about the music they were making or the music that their contemporaries were making? That's a classical tradition where composers write about classical music, but it's not a jazz tradition at all. So he was, again, kind of following a classical paradigm when he started writing columns for the New York Age before he went into the Army, and then picked up again with the music dial and with rhythm once he got out of the Army. I think this was part of the sort of the intellectual process, the intellectual milieu that he felt that he was part of. And I suppose the poetry is the same thing. I mean, the poems are very funny. They're in their way. Some of them are quite whimsical. Some of them are quite dark. Some of them are quite lovelorn. I mean, Herbie was a lovelorn figure, unfortunately.
I'll have more of Herbie Nichols' music and my interview with his biographer Mark Miller in just a few moments. You can hear a previous program about modern interpretations of Herbie Nichols' music on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, and 100% fruit smoothies made with locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Herbie Nichols' Third World on Nightlights. I'm featuring the music of pianist and composer Herbie Nichols on this edition of Nightlights. Nichols celebrated today as a forward-thinking artist, but largely ignored in his lifetime. To get by, he had to play numerous Dixieland and R&B-oriented gigs. And some of the young, more avant-garde-minded players who would later promote Nichols' legacy, such as trombonist Roswell Rudd, were on the Dixieland circuit as well. Older players were present too, and Mark Miller says Nichols, whatever his inner creative feelings might have been, was at professional ease in this environment.
He was conversant with all the panel styles of jazz, that he could play anything you wanted him to play. And when you think about the Dixieland scene of the 50s, it was a kind of catch-all musically. You had dyed-in-the-wool Dixieland players. You had a lot of swing-era veterans who had to go somewhere to play after the big bands fell by the wayside. They were out of work. So when you look at the bands that were playing Dixieland in that period, you'll find someone like Rex Stewart, with whom Herbie recorded in 1953. Well, Rex Stewart came out of the Ellington Band. He came out of the swing era. But here he was playing, you know, unapologetic Dixieland. So it would seem reasonable that Herbie would be able to mix in with that kind of potpourri of players.
Herbie Nichols soloing on trumpeter Joe Thomas's Blues for Baby from the 1958 album Mainstream, one of the few recorded instances that highlight Nichols in a more traditional jazz setting. There was a brief moment in the mid-1950s when Herbie Nichols thought he had made good as his Blue Note records were hitting the market and he was getting a bit of attention in the jazz press. He also crossed paths with one of the era's most famous jazz singers, Mark Miller, on the genesis of Herbie Nichols' Lady Sings the Blues as a Billie Holiday signature tune.
Lady Sings the Blues is to Nichols what Round Midnight is to Monk, in the sense that they're probably the best-known tunes by each of those guys, but neither is especially characteristic of their music. And Lady Sings the Blues was originally a piece called Serenade. And as I understand it, Billie Holiday heard Herbie playing it at Club 82, which was essentially a drag bar in New York. And Herbie was filling in, I think, there at some point. And she liked both his playing and that particular composition. So she took the composition over and wrote lyrics to it, Lady Sings the Blues, which conveniently was also the title of the autobiography, supposed autobiography, that was being published in 1956. But she also hired Herbie, which was interesting. And he was, for a minute, her pianist. And I'm not sure that they ever did anything but rehearse. And in fact, when Billie Holiday went into the studio to record that particular song and the others that came out on the LP that was timed to go with the autobiography, when she recorded that song, Herbie didn't show up. He wasn't in the band. He, I think, withdrawn. And Wynton Kelly made the date. And I think the situation there was that if you think of Herbie being as straight-laced as he was, he would have found it very difficult to be working with Billie Holiday, and, you know, knowing of her various addictions and her, you know, volatile personality. They're just a very unlikely match.
Herbie Nichols' instrumental version of Lady Sings the Blues, famously recorded by Billie Holiday in the 1950s, with Al McKibben on bass and Max Roach on drums, from the Blue Note album The Herbie Nichols Trio. Despite his burst of recording activity with Blue Note in the mid-1950s and a handful of generally positive reviews, Nichols was unable to achieve the success that would allow him to support himself as a group leader and as a performer primarily of his own music.
He was writing complex pieces at a time when complexity was not favored, and the winds of jazz were blowing in a different direction. He also had a lot of trouble just finding work. I think I found maybe four or five instances where he led his own band playing his own music in New York. And this is over a period of several years. So how do you keep a working band together? How do you get guys to come by and rehearse the music on a regular enough basis that they would become, you know, instantly or completely conversant with it? I don't think he had that luxury. The recordings that he did for Blue Note, and I presume for Bethlehem, were done after one or two rehearsals with musicians who hadn't necessarily played his pieces at all before. He did have an ongoing sort of rehearsal band situation with Roswell Rudd. Sometimes it was just the two of them, but they would get together in a loft and other people would come by. Stu Swallow was there occasionally. Archie Shepp was part of that. One or two drummers. But never did he have the opportunity to really sit down with guys and you know, whip the repertoire into shape.
Thank you.
pianist Herbie Nichols performing Spinning Song with Teddy Kotick on bass and Max Roach on drums from the Blue Note album The Herbie Nichols Trio and from his last recording session for the label. A tune Nichols described as telling a tale of living from week to week, how we all begin each new round of our lives with a bold knockout punch. We spin out our days in alternating songs of triumph and the blues. Biographer Mark Miller on how Herbie Nichols' character also perhaps impeded his career.
He also had this sense of integrity that made it difficult for him to be anyone except who he was, especially as it related to music, so that the compromises and the choices that another musician might make in the name of advancing his career were not things that he seemed prepared to make on his own behalf. And I think that there's a funny kind of, it almost seems self-defeating, a sense that he actively was setting himself apart. And I point to that portrait that he wrote about himself for Metronome, where this was his first opportunity to present himself to the readers of Metronome, which was Downbeat's rival during the 1950s. It's the first opportunity to introduce himself to a lot of jazz fans who wouldn't have heard of him before. But what does he do? He writes about his music in terms of modern classical music. There are all these references to Shostakovich and Bartok floating around, which I'm sure would have left the average jazz fan just scratching his or her head.
In 1957, Herbie Nichols made his last professional recording as a leader, a date for the Bethlehem label. This record hasn't been held in quite the same esteem as Nichols' Blue Note albums, possibly because the music hasn't been circulated as much, perhaps because the pianist approach seems in some ways less bold. But Mark Miller thinks that in other ways, Nichols' Bethlehem album is better than the Blue Note sides.
I find in some way that Herbie's playing on the Bethlehem sides is fresher than it is on the Blue Note sides. One has the sense, I have the sense, that there was a degree of nervousness in his playing when he was recording for Blue Note. You know, it was his big opportunity, first time to record his own music, his big break. So there's an unsettled quality, I think, to his playing. The tunes are great, but the playing I find a little bit repetitive. There's less of that to my ear on the Bethlehem. Not as well recorded a collection of pieces, but there may be a broader range of music there, both in terms of his own compositions and also the fact that he includes some standards, which of course might have been at the insistence of the producer and just to, you know, give the thing a bit more commercial potential.
Thank you.
Herbie Nichols' Every Cloud from the 1957 Bethlehem album Love, Gloom, Cash, Love, with George DeVivier on bass and Danny Richman on drums. Nichols continued to write music for the last 5 years of his life, even though he'd never record again as a leader. He won the allegiance of younger avant-garde musicians like Roswell Rudd and Archie Shepp and made a trip to Europe with the Dixieland Band. But the grind of his economically hard-scrabble life and the sense that the jazz world had passed him by took a toll on Nichols' morale and on his health. The final straw may have been a very strange gig that Nichols took on in the winter of 1962 and 63.
He had what one musician called the gig of last resort, which was to go and play at a NORAD base in Greenland at Thule. And he was up there for, weeks, this sort of desolate, frigid base with admittedly something like 10,000 people up there. But it was, he bowed around going through tunnels because it was so cold outside, and he played the various servicemen and officers' clubs in what sounds like a quasi-jazz Dixieland kind of band. He came back from there very ill, but even then, he didn't seek out medical attention. He went back to the Riviera, which is a sort of very downscale Dixieland club, which is the place where he was, verbally abused by the leader all the time. And it wasn't until, I guess, he really didn't have any other choice that he got himself into a hospital. And that's when they found very late on that he had leukemia and that he basically didn't have any prognosis. But when Roswell Rudd went to visit him, he found Herbie, playing chess and writing poems and just generally being Herbie and being optimistic, not really until, I think, literally the last two or three days, even prepared to acknowledge that he was in fact dying.
In 1957, Herbie Nichols told Nat Hentoff, "I'm a guy who's been broke all my life, and music is a release for me. It's the way I can keep on living." Years later, Roswell Rudd recalled a New York loft party where a tall, quiet piano player joined in a jam session and transformed its direction in a strange and magical way. "I found myself thinking more carefully about each note I played and started reaching for ideas that had never occurred to me until then," Rudd wrote. Soon the mysterious pianist departed, but the music continued on in a suspended, spell-like state. The pianist was Herbie Nichols, and though he left this world long ago, the gentle glow of his music continues to grow. I closed with Herbie Nichols doing the title track from his 1957 Bethlehem album, Love, Gloom, Cash, Love, with George DeVivier on bass and Danny Richman on drums. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Mark Miller. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, and 100% fruit smoothies made with locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can listen to other Nightlights programs and view playlist, jazz news, and commentaries on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. This is David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.